Okay, so this morning we're going to begin by doing another topic, which is the action for a relativistic particle. In general relativity. And the important thing to keep in mind is the geometrical picture. So we have some curved space, M, and we have some particle traveling along it. Okay, now we want to write down an action principle. And the question is, what could the action be for a particle traveling on a curved space-time? So tell me what you think it could be. So I just have to draw a curve on the space-time, and I've got to associate a number with it. So what's the only reasonable number to associate with any curve?
Length.
The length.
Proper time.
Pardon?
Proper time.
Yeah, the length of the curve. Okay. If the curve is space-like, the proper time is not going to help you that much. But if we take the curve to be time-like, then there will be a sensible proper time associated with it. If it's time-like, the proper time will keep increasing. And so the action is just the action is going to be minus some parameter times the proper time. And you'll remember that space-time is locally Minkowski. And if a curve is time-like, that means that the proper time increment is always positive as I go along the curve. And so this action will just grow with the length of the world line. Now, I put in some constants here. And actually, if I do the dimensions correctly, I believe there should be a C here. The reason is that the dimensions, so I'm going to use C equals 1, okay? But just to orient you, remember the action for a non-relativistic particle is kinetic energy, dt. Okay, so the dimensions of this is P dx. The action is P dx. And when we do quantum theory, we'll be interested in a path integral which has e to the is over h bar. And so the action better have dimensions of h bar. And so if you think about it, 1 over h bar P dx is dimensionless because h over dx is a momentum, right? From the de Broglie formula, P is h bar over lambda. So the action should have units of h bar, which is, in other words, units of momentum times length. And mc has dimensions of momentum, and tau, the way I defined it, has dimensions of length, because tau is, remember, we put a ct in front of the, we put a c in front of the time, so that we measure proper time in units of length. So I'm going to, I can leave the C in there. That's fine, just don't let me forget it, because I've forgotten it in my notes. So so this is just some parameter with the right dimensions. Dimensions of momentum. And but it will turn out that M is indeed the rest mass of the particle. That's why I choose that notation. And this action, if we work it out, so what is d tau? That's equal to minus mc integral square root minus g mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, because that was the definition of d tau. So I'll introduce a parameter, parameterization of the curve, lambda. So there's going to be some parameterization along here. So imagine that tau is some monotonically increasing function of lambda. Lambda can be any parameterization at all. And then this is minus g mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. So that is the action for a relativistic particle. And you can see from the way we derived it, it is reparameterization invariant. Right, i.e., replacing lambda by any lambda twiddle of lambda, which should be monotonically increasing. Leaves the action invariant. Okay, so obviously if I replace d lambda by d lambda twiddle, d lambda twiddle is d lambda twiddle by d lambda times d lambda. But then I've got, if I replace these by d lambda twiddle, I'll have exactly the same factors, but inverted, and I take the square root, these two Jacobian factors will cancel. So that action is reparameterization invariant. And sometimes that action is called, sometimes called the Nambu form. The terminology really comes from string theory. Now, in string theory, I don't have a world line. I have a string. A string in space sweeps out a world sheet in space-time, right? It sweeps out a two-dimensional surface. And so what is the action for a string?
Area.
Just the area of the world sheet, okay? So all we do is replace this d tau by a dA, which is the area. We put in a quantity with dimensions of, with the right dimensions, so that multiplied by the area, it gives something with dimensions of h bar, and that's the that is the Nambu action for a relativistic string. I'm not going to speak about that unless somebody asks. But this is the obvious action to start from for a relativistic particle. And now what we're going to check is that if I vary this action, then I recover the GD's equation. So let's vary the action. So definition of the variation of the action is I compute the action for some path x plus delta x of lambda, and I'll subtract off the action or the original path. Okay, so the variational principle means that the variation of the action should be zero to first order in delta x around the classical path. And the reason for this in quantum mechanics is very simple. We're doing a path integral over all paths with a weighting factor e to the is over h bar. And what we're looking for is the stationary phase path. We're looking for a path in which when we do this integral, the S is stationary, and that will dominate the quantum mechanical path integral. But in classical mechanics, we simply take this as the definition of the action. The variation of the action gives the, it's the quantity whose variation gives the equations of motion. So we can work this out. Minus m integral d lambda. And now I've got to vary this quantity under the square root. Okay, so the first thing is to vary the square root. So I get a half. I get 1 over square root. Whoops. 1 over square root minus g mu nu x. Let me write it as x comma sigma. X comma lambda. In fact, I'll call it x prime. X prime mu, x prime nu, where x mu prime is dx mu d lambda. Okay, so I just varied the square root, and now I've got to vary the stuff inside the square root. So first of all, I have to vary the g. But when I vary g, what I get is the derivative of g times delta x. So I get minus g mu nu comma alpha delta x alpha. Okay, this is the variation of g mu nu, because g mu nu is a function of x. So if I think about varying g, I've got to vary its argument, right? So it's g mu nu at x plus dx minus g mu nu at x. And that means I just do a Taylor series in delta x, keep the first order term, and that's the variation of the g. And I have my x prime nu, x prime nu. And now I've got to vary those x prime terms, and they both give an equal contribution. So I'll get g mu nu delta x nu prime delta x nu, sorry, x nu prime. So that's the variation of the action. And now, as usual, we need to integrate by parts to get rid of the time derivative of the variation so that we have some quantity times the variation, and that quantity will be the equations of motion. Okay, so we want to integrate by parts. Now, the trick you can use is the following, which is that, so let us define a derivative with respect to the proper time, tau. Now, that is equal to 1 over the square root of minus g mu nu x prime nu d by d lambda. Okay, because d tau is just this quantity, and this quantity times d lambda, the d lambda is cancelled. So you notice that here I can write this. So this quantity, I can write this, all of this. I just write it out again. So it is 1/2. And then absorb this in the d by d lambda, so I get minus g mu nu comma alpha delta x alpha, then x dot mu x prime nu, because there's only one factor of the square root, right? Minus g mu nu x dot nu delta x prime mu. Okay, so now I'm going to integrate by parts with respect to lambda and derive an equation for this quantity prime. So if I integrate by parts, okay, this becomes plus, and then g mu nu x dot nu prime. Okay, and the whole thing becomes this minus g mu nu comma alpha x dot mu x prime nu. And let's bring out the delta x alpha, the delta x, and so relabel that index as alpha, and that's the whole expression. There's a factor of two. Okay, so what is that? So this should be equal to zero. So the integral of this should be zero for all variations, delta x alpha of lambda. And therefore, the coefficient must be zero, right? Because if an integral times of something times an arbitrary function is zero, then the something must be zero. And so this gives us the following equation. G mu nu x dot mu. Now it's prime there, but I can always divide by that square root again to turn the prime into a dot. And then if I do that, this prime will also turn into a dot. And so g mu nu x dot mu dot will equal to 1/2 g alpha beta comma mu x dot beta. Okay, so that's our geodesic equation. And I can work this out. So this is actually x double dot mu plus 1/2. So take the derivatives of g, use the fact that g mu nu dot equals, g is a function of x, which is a function of tau. So this is g mu nu comma alpha x dot alpha. And if I differentiate that, I'll get the partial derivatives of g. So I get x double dot mu plus 1/2 g mu beta g lambda beta comma nu plus g nu beta comma lambda minus g lambda nu comma beta x dot lambda x dot nu equals zero. And of course, that is just the Christoffel symbol. This is equal to the mu lambda nu.
Could you repeat how you got rid of the primes?
The primes? In this equation?
Yeah.
I just took this equation, so this must be zero, right? Mm-hmm. That's the equation of motion.
Yeah.
And I just divide it by the square root.
Okay.
And when you divide by the square root, a prime turns into a dot. So this prime turns into a dot, and this prime turns into a dot. Okay, so the geodesic equation with the Christoffel symbol is the path of stationary length. In fact, if you think about it, the solution is actually the maximum of the proper time, right? Because you have this particle moving in a time-like direction. If it went null, the proper time would be zero. Proper time is zero along a null path. Proper time is positive. It's stationary. It better be a maximum, okay? And so actually, particles are, if you like, as sluggish as possible. They take as long as they can to do things. Yeah, is there a question? Yeah.
Yeah, your x mu was a prime and it changed into a dot.
Yeah.
That's something I don't see.
Sorry, this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
it's a prime?
Yeah, that's a prime.
And the box?
That's a prime, that's a dot.
Yeah.
That's a dot, and that's a prime.
And in the box to the right, is there, are there primes, are there dots, or there?
Sorry, in which?
In the box, like.
No, these are all dots. All dots. Okay, so I just explained this.
Yeah.
That's what he asked. How did I go from there to there? I took this equation. This must be zero. This quantity must be zero. I divide by the square root. These are primes. I divide by the square root. That converts the prime into the dot. And that converts this prime into a dot.
Nice.
They're two primes. It's linear in the primes. I divide by the square root. I get both of them dots.
But isn't it still the integration over the lambda?
Yes, it is.
So then if you are doing integration by parts, is it OK?
No, OK. So I've already done the integration by parts. Look at this line. That's a prime. This is an integral over lambda, right? OK, that's a prime. I did the integration by parts over lambda. That put that prime onto this quantity with a minus sign. That's how I got this quantity with the prime. Now I set this zero, because for all variations delta x, this quantity must be zero. So set this zero. Once I've set it zero, I'm free to divide it by square root. It still better be zero. And that gives that equation.
But why did you put the self's term equals zero?
Sorry?
The surface term, because when we integrate...
Whenever we do variations of action, we ignore the surface term.
Couldn't you...
The definition of an action is I fix the initial coordinate and the final coordinate at some initial lambda and some final lambda, and I vary it. So the delta x, by definition, must vanish at the end point. So there is no surface term.
You could have done the exchange there and the... Change the lambda to the tau in the previous step, and you will also get division by square root. Wouldn't you?
I don't want to do that because I want to integrate by parts.
Yeah, but if you do that, then you can.
Well, I guess that's true.
Foliago.
Yeah, I feel like. I mean, it's a d lambda, and then there's a d by d lambda, so I can at that point change to the d tau. But conceptually. What an action means is that there is a parameterization lambda, and I fix the initial and the final values of the fields, and I vary them in between. So I think it's actually clearer not to do that. But of course, it's equivalent. OK, everybody happy? Yeah. OK, now I'm going to tell you that isn't actually the best action to use. Unfortunately, when you do the quantum theory, that's a pretty bad action because it has a square root in it. And the equations of motion, what's to say? No, for example, you see, when I quantize, it's very important to calculate the canonical momentum, because the commutation relations are between the momentum and the coordinates. And the problem is, in this Nambu form, the action has square roots. And basically, everything is really messy. You've got square roots of operators in the fundamental quantities. And so there is actually an improved formulation, which in fact we're never going to do any quantization, but it's good to use this improved formulation anyway. And the improved formulation is it's actually more adaptable. This improved formulation, no square roots, so quantization is better. And the improved formulation works as following. As follows, it says, what is the world line of a particle? Well, it's just a manifold. It's another manifold, okay? So a particle living in a space-time is really a one-dimensional manifold embedded in a four-dimensional manifold. And a one-dimensional manifold should have its own metric, okay? So let's use that. And so what you do is the following. We write the action in this way. MC, I'm going to forget about C. Okay, you can put the C's in later. So forget, set C equals 1 from now on. this is, let me just write it down. So we introduce the following. We introduce this variable E, and E is called an einbein, okay, which is a joke on the name Feuerbein. The Feuerbein I told you about before is this quantity E mu A. There are four of them. A goes from 1 to 4, and so it's a sort of four-legged quantity. Well, E is just a one-legged quantity. It's just a number. And you should think about this as the square root of the metric along the world line. And the only important properties we need is that E prime of lambda prime actually transforms as d lambda prime times E of lambda. Okay, so if I squared that equation, and E squared is the metric, then that would be the correct transformation law for the metric. Okay, so... So I have this quantity E, and by definition, it transforms in this way. And so because of that, this is still reparametrization invariant, okay? Because the there are two these are primes. There are two d lambdas in the denominator here. So I have E d lambda, so we... And we have E prime d lambda prime equals E d lambda. So in this term, I have E d lambda in the denominator. Here I have E d lambda in the numerator, but both of them are invariant under coordinate transformations. And so the action is invariant. So this is reparametrization invariant. Okay, so this is my new action, and I really think about this as a system with kind of gravity in one dimension, okay, where E is now a dynamical variable in the theory. And if I vary this action, delta by delta E, what I get from here is just G mu nu x prime nu over E squared is equal to minus 1. Okay? Because when I vary this term, I just get minus 1 over E squared delta E. And over here, I get minus delta E. Set the total variation to 0. And it gives me this equation. But this is nothing but i.e. G mu nu U mu U nu equals minus 1. Okay, where the four velocity U mu equals 1 over E x prime mu. So that's good, you see, and so this action actually gives me the what will turn into the Machel condition, the p squared equals m squared condition for a massive particle. So plus corresponds to the sign here for a massive particle with a time-like world line. If I put 0 there, I would get a photon, right? A null particle, because if I had no term here and I vary this, I'll just have g mu nu u mu u nu is 0. That's the right equation for a photon. And if I have a plus e, then I would have a tachyon. So this is the correct action without any square roots for a relativistic massive particle. And you can check that if I work out E from this equation, okay, so I varied with respect to E, this gives me my answer for E, and I substitute it back in here, this equation tells me that E is minus... that E is the square root of minus G x prime x prime. And if I put that back in here, you'll see that these two terms combine. S equals M. So both of these terms combine. You can think about this as minus of minus G x prime x prime. E is the square root of minus gx prime x prime. So this term is just the square root in the numerator. This term is the square root, so you get a factor of 2. And the action is just minus m integral the square root, as before. So this action, if I work out what g is, substituted back in the action, actually gives me exactly the same action that I had before. And I'll just leave it to you as an exercise to show, in other words, eliminating E by its equation of motion just gives you back the action in the Nambu form. Yeah, go ahead.
So if we have the action in this form, we are supposed to vary with respect to both E and X.
Correct. Yeah, so I can write that explicitly. And by the way, E is a function of lambda, so when I vary it, it's at every single point, at every single lambda, right? I can only infer this equation because I vary this and I get something times delta E of lambda, and the coefficient has to be 0 at every single lambda, so I can throw the integral away.
Well,
okay, yeah.
Well, shouldn't this action change continuously in the case of massive particle to a non-massive something,
no,
something like
no,
that?
No, they're very different.
Well, I'm thinking about a neutrino or something like that, where some days suppose that they have no mass.
No, they're completely different. Neutrino with some mass is completely different to a neutrino with no mass, no matter how small the mass. They're really completely different. They have... Well, maybe the most dramatic example is, again, in the quantum theory, it's most obvious, but if you have a photon or a vector particle, with no mass, then there are only two states, positive and negative velocity. If you have a mass, three states. Doesn't matter how small the mass is. Okay, so that is a very singular limit, taking the mass to zero. And in this formulation, you'll see this. Yes, you see in the case of a photon, you can wonder what on earth is this parameter anyway. This parameter for a photon will turn out to be the energy of the photon as measured in some frame. Okay, and so so it that's just a parameter in general. We'll do some examples in a moment. Hopefully that'll make it clearer. Okay, so I was going to leave you as an exercise. Exercise, vary this S of E and X with respect to X and recover the geodesic equation. Okay, so when I vary this with respect to x, I again get a derivative of g times delta x. I get a delta x prime. I now integrate by parts, keeping in mind that keeping in mind with d tau equals e d lambda. Okay. So, which is essentially what this equation is telling you. Okay, this equation is exactly saying that E equals d tau d lambda. The equation of motion of E tells you that it is the factor converting you from lambda to proper time. So in some books, you will see this fact presented as a bit surprising, that you can write an action with the square root or without the square root, and it gives the same equation of motion. But actually, the two actions really are equivalent. Okay. And in a moment, well, I think next lecture, we will actually solve for the motion of particles, for example, in the background of a spherically symmetric solution of the Einstein equations, and it's always easiest to actually start from the action. Even though you know the geodesic equation and all that, it's in practice much easier always just start from the action in the situation you're in. It's the most direct route to getting all the equations right. Okay, so the next topic is probably the most exciting, which involves some physics, finally, which is to recover or to go from Newton to Einstein. And I sketched this in the last lecture, that we know Newton's equations of gravity. And we know that this constant, Newton's gravitational constant, comes into those equations. And so how do we recover the correct equations for G, for the metric, such that the curvature of the metric will describe gravity? So Newton is only valid for slowly moving particles, because Newton didn't know about special relativity. So the first step is to take dx d tau for the particle much less than dx d tau is much less than 1. And remember, I took tau to have dimensions of length, so this is a good dimensionless quantity. And then the geodesic equation so dx d tau is much less than 1. And, of course, the other interesting quantity in the geodesic equation will be dct d tau, because remember, ct is x naught. And if dx d tau is much less than 1, then dct d tau must be of order 1. Okay? Because we have... if the components of the metric are of order 1, which they will be in any locally inertial frame, because I can always pick a frame such that G is just eta at that spacetime point. And if G is eta, then, of course, we have d tau equal to square root of c squared dt squared minus dx squared, right, at a point. And so that's what we're interested in with slowly moving particles. The geodesic equation looks like this, d2x mu d tau squared plus gamma mu. Now, in principle, I have all four indices down here. But the point is that the dx d tau with the spatial indices is much smaller than the dct d tau. And so here I only have one term, okay, so that's the geodesic equation, i.e. drop the dx d tau. Okay, and now we will assume the metric is stationary. So d by dt of g mu nu equals 0. And let's work out what this gamma is. Gamma mu 0, 0. Well, this means 1/2 g mu alpha, and then I'll have g plus g minus g. Okay, that was the formula for the Christoffel symbol. But the point is that the time derivative of the metric is 0, so both of these terms are 0. And so this is just minus 1/2 g mu alpha g 0, 0, comma alpha. But in fact, we see, so this implies that gamma 0, 0, 0 is now g... I want to make another approximation here, actually. I want to say, assume and g mu nu equals eta mu nu, the metric is flat space, plus h mu nu, which is a small correction. Okay, so we're going to assume that the metric is close to flat space, gravity is weak. And so I not only need G, but I need its inverse. But if I have a matrix, let's say I have a matrix A, which is 1 plus delta, and delta is small, what is the inverse matrix? It's just 1 minus delta, right? In fact, it's 1 minus delta plus delta squared over 2 plus, minus delta cubed over... sorry, it's just this, isn't it? Plus delta squared minus delta cubed. Taylor series of 1 over 1 plus x is 1 minus x plus x squared minus x cubed. And the same is true with matrices, because there's no issue about things commuting. But the inverse is 1 minus delta, so actually g mu nu, which is the inverse of g with downstairs indices, is eta mu nu minus h mu nu. And by h with upstairs indices, I mean raise the indices of h with eta. Okay, so I can I'll leave it to you to check that if I multiply this by that, actually I get 1 up to order h, and if I add corrections at h squared, I'll get I can ensure that I get 1 exactly to all orders in h.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
But if we multiply by two matrix this equation, will we not obtain the same equation but with indexes up?
Sorry, which?
We have an equation that g is equal to eta plus h.
Yes.
For example, we multiply from both sides with g matrices to raise both indexes. Will we not obtain just the same equation?
No. Okay, so. Yeah, so you're worried, why didn't I just take this equation and raise the indices with eta? The answer is I do not raise the indices of g with eta. I raise the indices of g with g. Okay? We're doing general relativity. So when you raise indices, you've got to do it with g, not eta. Okay? So if I have g mu nu and I want to raise an index, I multiply it with g alpha mu, and this gives me delta alpha nu. Okay, that's okay. But if I want to raise the indices of this guy, I need to know what g inverse is. And I don't know what it is. So I have to actually calculate what it is. And this is the inverse of that matrix. Okay, I can check this for you, that it is the inverse. Let's just multiply these two things together. Let's check that. So eta mu nu plus h mu nu multiplied by eta nu alpha minus h nu alpha. So I'm claiming that is the correct inverse. Let's work it out. Well, eta mu nu times eta mu nu alpha, that gives me my delta mu alpha. And then I get plus h mu alpha from this term. And from this one, I get minus h mu alpha. And these two cancel. Right? And so, and then I get an h squared term. So I get minus h mu nu h nu alpha. And this I need to cancel by correcting g upstairs. Okay, so if I add another term, CHH term there, then I can adjust the C to cancel that term, and so on. H doesn't have to have an inverse. There's no inverse of h here. Where is the inverse of h? H is a small matrix. I never inverted it. I raised its indices. That's not the inverse.
Oh, I see.
It is not true that h nu alpha is delta mu alpha. No. Okay? This is just h with raised indices. Any other questions? Good. So we've worked out G. We've worked out G inverse. And now we can work out this guy. But H is small, right? So when I work this out, eta is just a constant. It's minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So eta won't contribute to this at all. Because I differentiate a constant, I get 0. So the only contribution will be from the H. And furthermore, this G inverse involves eta and H. But the h term from there will give me an h squared. And I'm not keeping h squared. I'm only keeping h. So this I can write as approximately minus a half eta mu alpha. And I only need to keep the eta because, as I said, this is of order h already. So then h naught naught comma alpha. Okay, so it's equal to that to first order in H. Okay, so you actually don't need all this other stuff I told you. This is useful when you do other things, like gravitational radiation or whatever. But, right. So so what we have is that d2x by d tau squared. So if we take this equation 1, okay, and plug in this equation 2. So if I take the spatial components, mu equals I goes from 1, 2, 3, then d2x d tau squared is 1 half d ct by d tau squared times grad of h naught naught. So I'm just using there that I'm using there that eta ij is delta ij, okay, and this then becomes derivative with respect to xi, and therefore this is just an ordinary gradient. And similarly, if we take the zero component of that equation, dt, d of ct by d tau squared, I get gamma with a zero. Okay, so x, the mu is zero, so I get gamma zero. Here I get eta zero zero, is the only non-zero component, but h is time independent, d by dt is zero. So that's just zero. And so this equation implies that ct is equal to a plus b tau. In other words, this ct is just linear in tau. That's the general solution of this equation. And if that's true, then the d tau here, d of c tau equals b of d tau. Yeah. question. D of ct is b of d tau. And so when I look at this equation, here I'll have d tau is just some constant times dt. D tau is a constant times dt. And so actually these two, so let's call that 3. So 3 becomes just d2x by dt squared equals 1 half c squared gradient h naught naught.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so because t and tau are just linearly related, I can just replace the tau with t, and equation 3 becomes this. Now that is just the same as Newton, who told us that mass times acceleration is equal to minus is equal to mass times minus the gradient of the gravitational potential. Okay, and so what we see is that h naught naught is equal to minus twice the gravitational potential over c squared. And if you think, what is the gravitational potential? Well, gravitational potential is gm over r near a mass m. And that has dimensions of velocity squared, right? And so gravitational potential over c squared is actually a dimensionless number. So this is a sign that we're going along the right track. Can everybody see that? Is that okay? All right. So that was the first indication that this idea that gravity is nothing but gravity is encoded in the metric is correct. And if you work out in magnitude, the surface of the Earth okay, so here, put in Newton's constant, mass of the Earth, radius of the Earth, and what you find is that phi over c squared is approximately 10 to the minus 9 on the surface of the Earth. Okay, so that tells you that h naught naught is about 10 to the minus 9, so it's certainly very small. On the Sun, so this would mass Earth, radius Earth, minus mass Sun, radius Sun, phi over c squared is around 10 to the minus 6. So it's still pretty small, even on the surface of the Sun. Gravity is space is nearly Minkowski space. But on the surface of a neutron star, this number is about 1/10. Okay, so h is less than 1, but not by much on the surface of a neutron star. Okay, so that tells us how particles move in a metric, and that this metric can simulate the effects of gravity in Newton's theory. But the question is, what determines g? In Newton's theory, we have Poisson's equation, del squared phi is equal to 4 pi g rho matter. Okay, that's equivalent to phi being minus g integral d3r rho of r 1 over mod r minus r prime. Right? Because if I take this equation has a Green's function, del squared of 1 over mod r minus r prime equals minus, with a 4 pi, delta r minus r prime. Right? So so basically, this equation for phi is just saying that phi is gm, this is just the sum, this is equal to the sum of minus g dm, the mass element, over r. That's phi of r. Okay. So that's summarized in Poisson's equation. And Poisson's equation is now suggesting what the equation we need for H naught naught. So we expect something like d squared g naught naught equals minus h. So g naught naught was eta naught naught, which is just 1 or minus 1, plus h naught naught, which is minus 2 phi over c squared. And so multiply this by minus 2 over c squared, and we expect this. This rho m is the density of matter. Okay, this is the mass density. And actually, the mass density, we know from the formula E equals mc squared, that the mass density is related to the energy density over c squared. So it's minus 8 pi g rho over c to the fourth, where rho is the energy density. Okay, so we're looking for an equation like this, that second derivative of g is, and let me put twiddles here so you don't think this is an exact equation. We're looking for an equation which will produce this in the relevant limit. But rho, the energy density, is equal to T naught naught. Okay, this is the stress energy tensor. Okay, so Einstein already knew from special relativity that the energy density is just the time-time component of the stress energy tensor. And so we expect to find an equation, d squared g naught naught equals minus 8 pi g over c to the fourth t naught naught. That's not a tensor equation, so that can't be the right equation. So we must turn this into a tensor equation. So what is a tensor that involves second derivatives of the metric? Well, the only possibility is the Riemann curvature. And so on the left-hand side, we must have something involving the Riemann curvature. So this must be Riemann. And if we get a tensor equation, this must be T alpha beta. Okay, so the proposal, or the guess, on the right-hand side, I've got minus 8 pi g over c to the fourth t alpha beta. And on the left-hand side, I've got some constant times the Einstein tensor. Now, you see, why did I pick the Einstein tensor? I only have two tensors made out of the metric, which involve second derivatives of the metric. One of them, two symmetric tensors. One is the Ricci tensor. And I also have G alpha beta times R. Those are the only two quantities I have made out of Riemann, which are symmetric two-index tensors. And I know I need, for consistency, since the stress energy tensor is conserved, stress energy tensor obeys this conservation law, we must have d alpha of the left-hand side, alpha beta equals 0. And the only tensor available is the Einstein tensor. So remember, g alpha beta is r alpha beta minus 1 half g alpha beta r, and d alpha g alpha beta equals 0. Okay, so we still have a constant to determine. But the constant is quite easy because we simply calculate the Einstein tensor in terms of g naught naught. So let's just do that. So it's sufficient to work it out for one value of h. We only need to determine a single constant. And so let's work out what the Einstein tensor is. for g equals eta plus h. Now, in fact, it's enough to work out r. And remember, we had this formula. So the Riemann tensor with lowered indices I gave you last time. And if g is eta plus h, well, the derivatives on eta are 0, so I only have the h to worry about. And it's just given by this formula. Okay, so that was the second derivative of the metric. And then we had the gamma-gamma terms. Okay, but gamma is of order h, because gamma involves derivative of the metric, so gamma is of order h. And so these terms are h squared. So we can just neglect those. So everything comes from these terms. And you can easily see that r naught, 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 naught is 0. That's obvious because Riemann is anti-symmetric on these two indices. And so the first non-zero component you have to worry about is Ri naught J naught. Okay, I'm just going to calculate Riemann and then raise the indices to contract the indices to get Ricci and then construct Einstein. And so this is equal to. So if I've got rho is I, mu is j, and the others are 0, the only way I can get anything is if I don't have any time derivatives. Okay? So I better use up my rho and mu on the derivatives. Rho is I, mu is j. The only term with rho and mu in the derivatives is this one. So here I have I, j. These would be 0, 0. And so here I have minus a half h 0, 0, comma ij. And then this gives me that r 0, 0, the Ricci scalar, when I contract Riemann, so I raise one of those indices, I get minus 1 half grad squared h 0, 0. and that's what I want. Okay, so that's the relationship between the Ricci tensor and G naught naught in this weak field case. Now, I could compute the Einstein tensor, but I'm going to take a bit of a shortcut, which is note from over here, you see this is one version of the Einstein equations. So let's write the Einstein equations here as g alpha beta equals constant, call it k, times t alpha beta. That is r alpha beta minus 1 half g alpha beta r. So if you have that formula, you're free to contract indices. So now just multiply it with g alpha beta with the two raised indices. Okay, the left-hand side, I'll have k t lambda lambda equals, because I'm just contracting those two indices, the right-hand side, I have the Ricci scalar from this term. G with g, what's that equal to? What's g alpha beta, g alpha beta?
The
Sorry?
Delta alpha.
Yes, that's four, equal four. To delta alpha alpha.
Dimensional space.
Which is?
Four.
Which is 4. Okay, because this is 1 for every index. I have to sum over them. So I get a 4 here. So I get minus 2r. So this is minus r. So actually, r is minus k times the trace of t. So I can take this term to the other side. And I get r alpha beta is equal to k times t alpha beta minus 1 half g alpha beta t lambda lambda. Okay, so that's a completely equivalent form of Einstein's equation. If this is true, then this is true. Now, I've already worked out the R naught naught. On the right-hand side, I've got to work this out. Stress energy tensor, T mu nu, let's put it with downstairs indices. We've already discussed that the 0, 0 component is rho, the energy density. And then I just have zeros elsewhere. This is for non-relativistic matter, for non-relativistic okay, so T lambda lambda, I just have to raise the zero index, so that gives me a minus rho. And so over here, I have R 0, 0 equals kappa. T 0, 0 is rho minus a half G, minus a half G, so that gives me plus a half, because I take the G 0, G 0, 0, and then T lambda lambda is minus rho, so I get minus a half rho. So this gives me kappa rho over 2. And we know that this is, from over there, minus 1 half grad squared H naught naught. And so solve for kappa, and we'll find kappa is equal to 8 pi g. I know that H naught naught is minus 2 phi over c squared. Okay. And so this tells us kappa is 8 pi g over c to the fourth. So doing all that, all we find is this constant is 1, and that is the correct Einstein equations with a plus sign. Okay. Are there any questions? Yeah.
In the weak field limit that you took, why can you assume that the metric is stationary?
The picture is that we're going to just work for the sun, the Earth going around the sun. So let's just imagine that the body is static, and I have some particle traveling in orbit. So the geodesic equation will be for that particle in orbit. But when I calculate the gravitational field of the sun, it's reasonable to assume it's static.
You're assuming that it
doesn't change with time. So in fact, next time, so it's a good question, because why should I expect the gravitational field of some spherical body to be time independent? There is a very, very, very powerful result, which we'll prove next time, called Birkhoff's theorem. And Birkhoff's theorem says that spherical symmetry alone ensures that there is a coordinate system in which the metric is static. It's even more powerful than Newton. So Newton, you probably know the story. I guess Newton spent 15 years proving that the gravitational field of a spherical body was equivalent to that of a point mass centered at its center. And he didn't have any differential calculus or anything, so he had to use other methods to prove it. But in GR, there's an even more powerful theorem called Birkhoff's theorem. So for example, if you have an exploding star, if it's spherical, you can't tell at all. You can't tell that it's exploding until the stuff hits you. Okay? Because the metric outside will be exactly static. So this is, at this level, just an assumption. But in fact, it's in some situations, it's a very, very good assumption.
But yeah. it, think it's also related with the conservation of energy, right?
If a metric is static, then there is a symmetry under shifting time. And then there's a conserved quantity called the energy. So it kind of goes the other way around. If a metric is static, then there is a conserved energy. In general, there is not. For a general time-dependent metric, energy is not conserved. So you see, if you look at this equation, if we look at this equation, d alpha t alpha beta equals 0, this is energy conservation. Now, in flat space-time, this equation reads d alpha t alpha beta equals 0. So this tells you d naught of t naught naught is di minus di of ti naught. So I can take that equation and integrate it over some volume, okay? And then I can write it like as following. Time derivative of this spatial integral of t naught naught over some volume equals minus integral d3x or d3r gradient divergence of this let's call this p is pi will be ti naught. It's like a momentum flux d3x. Okay, but the point is that the integral of a divergence is, by the divergence theorem, is a surface integral. And providing there's no momentum crossing the surface, so this will be equal to minus integral p dot ds, and this will be 0 if there's no momentum crossing the surface. And so actually it tells you that this quantity is conserved, and this is the energy. Okay, so in special relativity, conservation of energy comes directly from this equation. In general relativity, this equation is not true. You've got the connection here. And that completely destroys this argument. So in general relativity, there actually is no quantity called the energy. Okay? There's no notion of conservation of energy, strictly. There, in some circumstances, there's a conserved quantity, which is in spacetimes which are asymptotically flat, you can define a conserved quantity, but it's all much more complicated. And basically, you have to include the energy in the gravitational field. It's not just the energy in the matter. The gravitational field itself has energy, and you have to combine those two into the conserved energy. Typical example is if you have the binary pulsar. You know, Joe Taylor got the Nobel Prize for checking the predictions of general relativity for the binary pulsar. So this is two neutron stars in orbit around each other, and the H is of order 1/10. So gravity is really strong. So obviously you have this metric which is being stirred, right? H is of order 0.1, and it's going up and down very quickly as these things orbit each other. So what happens when H goes up and down is that it sends off waves of H. And so you get gravitational waves. This H field propagates out, and it carries energy. And so the energy in the binary pulsar gets, it's negative. Gravitational energy is negative. You see, the gravitational potential energy is negative. And it can get more and more negative as it emits positive energy in the gravitational waves. And so actually, you do use energy conservation, where you count the energy in the gravitational waves. But that's definitely not in T. The energy in the gravitational waves is actually coming out of G. So what you do is you take this term, and you split it into a kind of space-time metric part, background metric part, and the gravitational waves. And then you take the gravitational waves over onto this side of the equation. You combine them with this energy. That's the total energy. Gravitational waves and the binary pulsar. So that's a whole long story, but in general, there is no conserved energy in general relativity. Any other questions? Okay, see you next time.
Okay. So before everyone leaves.
Oh, wait a second, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
I have something.
John wants to say something. Oh, okay.
Okay, so I wanted to talk to you all a bit about the tutorials because we're not actually very happy with the way that they're working now. We don't feel like they're really meeting the objectives that we've set. I think what the way that this happens is we're finding that you know, some people come in, they get the tutorial problems. For some people, they're relatively easy. They work on them for a little while, solve them, and then just get up and leave. Other people find them more challenging, and they're still working on them at the end, and that also isn't necessarily being resolved. This is not the way that we envision these tutorials working. For one thing, the tutorial is a big investment of our resources. The fellows are there to work with you for that time, and so we would hope that all of that time is being spent usefully. Also, for those of you who were here, most of you who were here at the beginning, we tried to explain that it isn't just solving the problems that we care about. I mean, we would like you to be able to solve the problems. If the problems are, you find them easy, then we would like you we would like you to be working together and helping each other out, be involved in, you know, if you like, if you understand something and other people don't, explaining, teaching. These are all part of the process of what we're hoping that you'll get out of the school. And so, you know, we would like, you know, it's important really to have full involvement in these tutorials. I mean, there's another reason. I mean, maybe we don't really talk about this all the time, but in terms of, I mean, we do evaluate how everyone is doing, and that's done, the people who are in closest touch with you are the fellows, and believe me, they're very interested in what everyone is doing in the class, and they take note of all of that. And so it's from the point of view of them being able to tell you how you're doing and help you do better, I think that's, it's important that they have the opportunity to interact with you at that time. Just from your own points of view, it's important that we know how well you did while you were here for many different reasons, which you can easily imagine. But let me just say that, you know, it's, in terms of evaluation of physics students, I mean, there's a wide range of abilities and there's an even wider range of preparation in this class, and that's exactly the way that we want it to be. But when you think in terms of how well can one do in a program like this, just being able to solve the problems quickly doesn't take you very high up the scale, okay? There are other things that you can do. You can go beyond what you're asked. You can be good at explaining things to other people. You can be good at presenting things to other people. There's many levels of accomplishment in this business, and it's more or less open-ended at the top. So, I mean, these are all things that we care about and you should care about and we're looking for in the tutorials, and which are an important part of the program. Now, we're going to try to see if we can organize things a little better and a little differently, make them a little more challenging or perhaps more interesting, have people, you know, perhaps presenting solutions at the end of the tutorial, preparing solutions that we can keep on the wiki. But the point is, and this is a work in progress, and it's something that the fellows are very interested in. You may be interested in it. We would love to hear what ideas you have about how to make the tutorials more effective. But I think the point is that we feel, and maybe some of you feel, that the time that's spent on tutorials could be better use. And so over the next few weeks, we'll see if we can find more effective ways of doing it. So that's just something that the fellows and I wanted to explain see what we can do about it.
Good. Yeah, maybe I can just reinforce that in two ways. One is Psi is supposed to be a different kind of program, okay? But this relies on you, not only us. And it's different in that at university, you may be used to just going to a lecture and disappearing to your room and working everything out yourself. That is not what Psi is supposed to be. Psi is supposed to help you in many ways with improving your skills, as John said, to interact with other people, explain, and collaborate. If you're not doing that, then you are not participating in Psi as we intended. So it's even though this may seem a pain to you that I've got to explain this to some other people, I can assure you it is not a pain. And if you, in the sense that if you become good at explaining things to other people, this is a very, very important skill, which will serve you, not only it will make your time here in Psi much more enjoyable, but it will serve you extremely well in the future. Not just for teaching, where it's essential, but in research. In research, a vital skill is the ability to explain things to others. And if you can't do that, I would say you're actually kidding yourself that you understand something. You only really understand something when you can explain it clearly to somebody else. And so we really want you to do that and stay around in the tutorials and interact with each other and help each other. I did emphasize that in the beginning of the course. And I hope you'll respond. And the second thing is to say that today I will be here at 4 o'clock, and I hope you all are. Okay? I will be looking to see that you're all here. And so please be here at 4 o'clock. I'm sorry that on my part I have so much other things to do that I tend to be unavailable in the afternoon, but I'm going to make a special effort to come, as John said, and I want all of you to. Yeah.
Tomorrow.
Yes. Tomorrow.
I don't even know when it is.
Tomorrow. So, you know, as John said, let's look at this course. Okay, so maybe you can blaze through the problems pretty easily. But I've given you readings. I've given, you know, you have tons of textbooks. Pick problems. Try and work on something. And ideally, show that you can help other people keep up with the material. It's really very important because this stuff is like the foundation for the rest of the year, and we want to make sure that every single person in this class feels comfortable that with this material, so they can go on and build on it. And we're just asking for all of your help to ensure that's really the case. All right, thanks.